This is Terrence McNally. I've been doing this show for quite a while before joining Progressive Voices. And this week I'm going to share with you one of my favorite previously recorded interviews with Tom Shadyac, former blockbuster comedy director, about his book Life's Operating Instructions, in which Tom asks whether life comes with such a set of guidelines. If so, what are they? And finally, do we have the courage to act on them even if we found them? This interview originally aired in July 2013. I sometimes say that in a past life, I worked in the entertainment industry. Comedy in particular. I co-wrote and co-produced novelty records. The Homecoming Queen's Got a Gun, I Like 'Em Big and Stupid, Earth Girls Are Easy, all performed by Julie Brown. I directed comic music videos for some of these songs, and I ended up co-writing and co-producing the film Earth Girls Are Easy. It was a wild ride, and in 1989, I showed up at my 20th college reunion, and that film was playing at the Harvard Square Theater. And while I was a regular that season on Knott's Landing. So I made a speech at that reunion asking my classmates what we were doing to live up to our youthful ideals. We'd been the class that shut down Harvard over ROTC and African-American studies and being a bad landlord. And I came back to L.A. and I got involved with environmental organizations and began a move toward the work that I do today. I've produced and hosted this show since 1996, and I consult and speak primarily to nonprofits and foundations, working with them on communications, encouraging them to tell better stories. Now, my transition seems mild compared with that of today's guest, Tom Shadyac, whose phenomenally successful writing, directing, producing career includes the hits Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, Liar, Liar, The Nutty Professor, Bruce Almighty, Patch Adams. His films grossed nearly $2 billion, with a B, and earned him four People's Choice Awards and a ton of money. His 2011 documentary, I Am, recounts what happened after a cycling accident left him incapacitated for months. Though he ultimately recovered, he emerged a changed man. In the film, Shadyac meets with a variety of thinkers and doers, including David Suzuki, Noam Chomsky, the late Howard Zinn, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, asking basically two questions. What's wrong with society, and what can we do to make things better? Tom's now written a book, Life's Operating Manual, which asks whether life comes with such a set of guidelines. And if so, what are they? And finally, do we have the courage enough to pay attention and to change? I sometimes use a format on this show I call It's Broke, Let's Fix It. We focus on a problem area, say public education or the war on drugs, and then I ask three big questions. How is it broken? What's the evidence? How did it get broken? What's the history? And finally, how do we fix it? What are the solutions? And Shadyac has basically taken that approach with all of contemporary society and its cultural story in particular. So rather than spoil the plot by telling you his answers, we'll jump into the conversation. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Welcome back to Free Forum, Tom Shadyac.
Good to be here. I didn't know we shared the same history, this shift.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, you're just further down the road, so I'm looking at my future.
Well,
right
you
here.
Went further up the mountain.
Yeah, well, I'd hope to go on further down this path as well and have more conversations.
And it's funny how we also have the Jim Carrey
I was going to say, Earth Girls Are Easy. Yeah. Yeah, we both work with Jim. Jim is the key into the next phase of your life.
Yeah. It's all of you. As you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Now, I mentioned a few highlights, including your film success and your accident and so on. And in fact, your story is kind of a scaffolding that your film and this book sort of start from or rest on. So can you briefly bring to life your path to the work that you see yourself doing today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a small town, a suburb of Washington, Falls Church, Virginia. And there were two forces in my life that kind of shaped me. One was the moral ethics, the foundation of which was the Catholic Church, which I was raised. You were Catholic as well.
Right.
We shared that again.
Yeah.
Guilt, again, being another access point. And what I heard inside of the Catholic story that moved me was the morality, the values, the ethics, the ethos of the central figure, Jesus. It wasn't the dogma. But that was a very powerful part of my life. The second informing narrative was what the culture was teaching me, which was what was important in life. And it was these counter ideas to the moral values which I was learning. It was to accumulate as much as you could. It was giving me a definition of success that had to do with square footage, amount of money, personal power, position, etc. And I was able to walk that path, as you said, through my art. I graduated from the University of Virginia as a government major and very naturally went into joke writing. So you could see comedy is based on absurdity. And my first job was in government as a Senate page. And I could see the absurdity of this. I mean, we literally had to learn how to hold the water glasses of senators without putting our fingerprints on them. So I could see this absurdity, this gap between how we live our lives and how the positions of power tell us to live. But I walked down that path of success when I got into show business. I decided to try this, what I believed was a gift that I had for making people laugh. And I found a tremendous amount of success there after a lot of struggle. But then when I got those fruits, when I got the spoils, if you will, it's called spoils for a reason, I felt it spoiled. I saw this gap. I felt this hypocrisy between what I was taught and what moved me in my life. And I simply, which is what Life's Operating Manual is about, I want to use and follow the principles according to what works. And if those principles, the accumulation, the power, the position, the status, the fame had worked, I would be here
promoting
that gospel,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
But it didn't bring what it had promised. The hole, if you will, inside each of us was not filled in any way. And yet, as I follow those morals and those principles of sharing my art, sharing my life, the principles of compassion, empathy, altruism, those did pay, if you will. They paid a deep, rich reward. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. And now I'm, as you are doing through this conversation, pursuing more of this path.
The bike accident plays a key point in because it's interesting. We interviewed when you made I Am the documentary, and I went back and looked at that one. And I remember saying, so were the questions, the itch, that sort of thing, already stirring before the accident? And then the accident happens, and I'll let you tell the story. But what I'm looking for in that is, if the itch was already happening, would the shift have happened without the accident?
Right. Well, it's hard to say because ifs are a very challenging subject. It's very likely that the shift would have happened because it is truly, I believe, the basis of who I am. So I would have found it one way or another. But maybe it would have been a different accident, if you will, an accident of spirit instead of a physical accident.
Yeah.
But no, you know, I don't know if I told the story as cleanly, and I am. I certainly didn't have a bike accident and then, quote, saw God and had this revelation.
Right. It wasn't like Paul falling off the horse. You fell
off
the bike.
Yeah, it was not Tarsus. Paul went to Tarsus and saw the image of Jesus. No, I had, as I said, as a young boy, I had felt the power of these ideas, and I had pursued those ideas, sometimes more passionately and dedicated than other times. But I'd always been interested in the writings of the saints and the sages and the mystics, the Thomas Mertons, the Gandhis, the Thoreaus, most recently Emerson and the poets. And it was the bike accident that caused me to make a film directly about my pursuit of these ideas. And I had been shifting my life for years. So when I got the spoils of success, they sort of came at liar, liar. You know, when I did Ace Ventura, I got Directors Guild minimum. So you didn't make a lot.
Right, right.
You did see the doors of, quote, access open up. Nutty Professor, the money started to come. Liar, liar, it really started to come. And it didn't feel right. I felt privileged to be an artist who was offered work and had access to work and talented people to work with. And that felt like it was enough. And then all this other stuff, money, wealth came with it. And it just didn't feel right. And I remember going out with a friend and I said that to him and he said, well, then you can give me some of it.
Right,
you know,
right.
Which most would say. But I felt something. I felt the gap. And of course, I didn't have the courage at that point. But I was giving away a fair amount of money at the time. I did feel the needs of others. I did feel this incongruity between what I felt and how I was living. And I did move to the mobile home park before. I did, you know, awaken to some ideas, especially when I saw how nature worked. You know, after I worked on Bruce Almighty with Morgan Freeman, Morgan's a real naturalist. You know, he's looked at nature very closely. And Morgan turned me on to Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, which is really a study of the spark of life in everything, the divine spark. And that shifted me greatly because when I realized my life was completely out of order with how nature worked, nothing in nature, of course, taking more than it needs.
Right.
I was taking everything that I could. That's what we're taught to do. That really shifted me. But these shifts had taken place before, and then the bike accident had me talk about it. It simply had me make a film about it.
I want to tell people the show and that sort of thing, but just quickly, the bike accident, we've referred to it a few times. You hit your head.
Yes.
And you get a concussion, but you get post-concussion syndrome. Just tell people what
that's
like. Yeah,
just the symptoms don't go away. This is why football players lock themselves up in rooms. They can't stay with their families. Any stimuli is like torture. It literally is a concussion that doesn't have an end, and that can be incredibly debilitating, not only physically but also emotionally.
Right. And so if people who've never had a concussion, that includes incredible sensitivity to light and sound and nausea and fogginess and just an inability to function.
Yeah, it's like a computer on overload. You just can't take in stimuli. Your computer's not functioning. And the only thing you can do is to literally shut it down. So I slept in a dark room for months on end. I slept in a closet, blackout curtains over
and
my
in your
whole
case,
house.
This was 4 or 5 months.
About 4 or
right.
5 months.
And you're saying that took what had been brewing in you and you're now confronting, what if I never can work again?
Yeah.
What if I never can do any – what or if I get the chance to work again, what is my work
about?
It was
literally a death.
This is Freeform. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Tom Shadyac, one of Hollywood's most successful comedy directors of films like Ace Ventura and The Nutty Professor. And as we were just saying, when an accident stopped all that in its tracks, he seized the opportunity to question his work and his success. His 2011 documentary, I Am, intersperses this story with a global search for what's gone wrong and how we can turn things around. He's recently published his first book, Life's Operating Manual, and you can learn more at lifesoperatingmanual.com. So you've got these questions. You decide you'll make the film and so on. Let's go back to what you were saying about nature and Dr. Quinn and so on. In other words, you have the itch. You've been reading the mystics, but my guess is that something happens here where it begins to speak more to you about society and not just the individual. Is that right?
Yeah, well, understand that the big revelation, one of the big aha moments for me was, again, this idea that I was not operating according to the laws of nature. So what are those laws? If we look around, we think we as a society have been told that competition is the ruling order of nature, survival of the fittest. That's a misunderstanding. Darwin didn't even come up with that phrase. It was Herbert Spencer. He used it twice. He used the word love 95 times.
Darwin, in the book Origin of Species.
95 times.
Love 95
times. Descent of
times.
Man, actually. Yeah. 95 times. I believe it was Descent of Man. 95 times. Anyone who looks at nature, a child who looks at nature, can see that it thrives based on cooperation. Competition absolutely exists in nature. It's a part of our strive toward excellence. However, what makes nature work is cooperation. A rainforest, everything in a rainforest is giving something to everything else.
Right. As I've said on this show in the past, having had many of the people that you cite, Elizabeth Sartoris and so on, it's that it is survival not of the fittest gene, as Dawkins would say, or not even of the fittest individual organism, but it's usually survival of an ecosystem. And it's the survival of that ecosystem which depends on the symbiotic, the cooperative, the collaborative relationships that they all live out.
Right. What makes nature strong is diversity, right? One species is not winning out. If it does win out, it's pretty much signed its death certificate because it's going to die because it needs other life forms as an ecosystem to support and sustain life. So when I learned that, I had learned my whole life that just make as much as you can. And then you can give away.
Right.
You know, that's right. That's what most people say. Well, why don't you just take it all and then give it away? And because I simply don't want to be greedy now to be generous later. I don't want to break one of nature's laws, cause the problems in the world, and then try to fix them with my other hand. So when I realized that, that was a real shifter for me. That meant I had to change the way I did my business life in terms of my art. And that's the one where wherever I go on and talk, whether it's on the radio or television, you hear the record scratch. Right. So you don't take everything you can. I just recently negotiated for a film.
You're going to do the Intouchables?
Yeah, Intouchables is a very beautiful, popular film out of Europe, and which not many Americans have seen because of the language barrier. We're gonna try to bring that to them. And I negotiated down my salary, to which everyone laughed at me.
Except your agents who were teed up.
Oh, my
they
agents
were upset because they're on a percentage of you.
They are on a percentage of me, and I will give them that percentage of me. But at some point when I rebuild, quote, what you would call power, what I don't call power, but what you'd call power in this business, I will create an account for others that'll never come to me. And they can still tax that as they wish. They can do what's their calling, and I'll do what's my calling. But on this film, I just said, no. This is a privilege to serve. Please pay me minimum. I don't want any more. And that in itself has an energy. Maybe someone someday would be inspired by that to possibly share more of their resources and their art. And so, but boy, did that set a shockwave of what happened to this dude. He's crazy. And by today's standards, I'm crazy, and I'm proud to wear that
label. What's funny is I actually read – I'm speaking with Tom Shadyac. I read a couple of articles about – you were saying that you were likely to do the Intouchables and so on. And they actually talked about sort of the negotiations aren't finished yet and so on, giving you the impression that it's because you were asking for so much. And my guess is that the reason the negotiations took a while was that you were not playing the game.
It's funny. I read that article too, and it was hilarious because it was the opposite.
Yeah.
Someone said the negotiations are complicated because I have a history of making a lot of money and being a point player, meaning you get a gross a point in the film or two. And yeah, and it was the opposite. So
and just for people, the Intouchables, I've seen it and I highly recommend it. Tell people what it is and why you decided this was the first. In other words, you did I Am, your first documentary, but this is your first back into the big picture kind of thing, why you chose this story.
Yeah, oftentimes we don't choose them, they choose us. And this one was chosen for me. It is about the relationship, interestingly, between a very wealthy man, someone with old wealth. And this is a true story.
That's right.
Someone who was very, very wealthy and of privilege. All the way, the wealth went all the way back to the Napoleonic era. His family got a percent. They were the first agents. And when that property began to be given out again, that was taken by Napoleon, he got a percent. His family got a percent. So it's about that gentleman who has an accident. He's a quadriplegic.
Paralyzed. Very wealthy person has an accident.
Here we
yes.
go. Paralyzed. There's another parallel coming. Paralyzed from the neck down. And then he takes into his life a very unlikely caregiver, which is a young man from the inner city. It's from the projects of France. And it's about how these two have much more in common than they have differences. And my mother, the other parallel is my mother was also a quadriplegic. She could move all four digits, but very, very, very slowly. So she was essentially confined to a wheelchair. And so the movie speaks very strongly to me and personally, especially since my mother, I know what it's like for a handicapped person to see the eyes of judgment. Whenever a handicapped person goes in a room, generally people have the, oh, poor person. And my mother, I know, never felt that way. She wanted to be treated. She wanted people to ask her questions. Do you pee in a bag? Does your bladder work? What's going on? And this kid actually has that energy with this older man. And so I know that world very well. And I'm really happy. And it's funny. I mean, it's very funny. It's a film laced with humor. And it also has pathos.
And was very successful in Europe. And
one of the most successful movies in history in Europe. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a very good chance to be so here. That's the voice of Tom Shadyac. We're talking about this transition he made from high priced comedy movie director, Ace Ventura, Nutty Professor, that sort of thing, to a new life. We've just been talking about the next film he's going to do, The Intouchables, an import from France. But he has also done a documentary called I Am, and we're talking about a new book called Life's Operating Manual, and you can learn more at lifesoperatingmanual.com. What has been the response to this book? We'll talk about the content more, but what's been the response so far? Anything that surprised you? Anything that's moved you to, oh, I wish I'd done something differently? Anything like that?
Well, yeah, I've already changed since I've written the book. you know how it is. You write a book, and then about a year later, it actually comes out, and after the edits and whatever. And I've actually evolved a bit, I think. I mean, the core of the book, I certainly support. I just have this mounting idea that it's all working out for good. And I would write an additional chapter, if you will, or additional, maybe it'll be the next book. But I just feel like life knows what it's doing, even with a species that we think of as kind of crazy and off. I think that offness of our species is necessary because it will teach us the onness of our species. Just like when you go and you travel internationally or when there's a flu season, oftentimes to boost your immune system, you introduce the disease. And so I think we're introducing the disease of how not to do things. You know, we've seen it in much more violent examples with things like the Holocaust and other atrocities. But we still see it today. It's showing up in gun violence in schools and in the economy that's broken for many. But I do think that life knows what it's doing, and we're quickly, relatively in terms of evolutionary scale, quickly going to wake up to the fact that this does not work.
Okay. One thing, by the way, now with the online presence of a book, that epilogue, if you will, you can add as soon as you get a break and put it up there, and then another, and then another.
Don't give me any ideas,
it's
man.
No, but it's pretty. you're right. You know, some writers Absolutely. Are doing that. It really does make it. The book is not a static, dead thing. It's kind of the taking off.
It's
point.
True, and now this book is actually. It surprised my publishers. It's selling. It did hit the New York Times bestseller list, and largely because of online with youth, as I was saying.
Off air, he mentioned that it's actually young people who are buying this book, which is interesting. And it may be because you have this weird personal story that kind
of. And I think it's also, well, first of all, my films are an access point, but also young people, they don't have the baggage that we have. They don't have 50 years of a societal messaging on their backs. They're still open to what might actually be reality.
Yeah. You anticipated criticism of your book, I assume, and you confront one of those criticisms immediately. At the very start of the book, raising the point that you are not the most likely or most qualified messenger. Talk about that.
Well, neither was Moses, who was a stutterer. And I'm not likening myself to Moses, but oftentimes life chooses those who are the least likely. If you look at someone who has a master's in theology and who has been preaching at a church for 25 years, you say, oh, I can see a book coming out like this from that person. But I'm a person who's been doing those things. I easily could have earned my master's, and I easily could have done many sermons and have spoken for years and years and years. But I've been someone who's been known as a comedy director. And so that, of course, invites criticism of what the.
Yeah.
And to me, that is an irrelevant conversation. It's talk about the substance of what's said. I completely understand. The fact that I have this history is virtually irrelevant. Talk about where the ideas
are. Well, except
are now.
I would say this, Tom. The fact that you have that history actually is not irrelevant in that it does the positive thing of getting you attention.
Right.
In other words, the person who's been, you know, who no one has heard of and who does it has never had any wealth and has the same research as you and writes the same book might not get the same. So I don't think it's irrelevant.
Well, you know what? I agree. I would take that back as opposed to irrelevant because everything is relevant. And my story is actually but if you're going to take my story, take the whole story, right? You were not with me when I was in my free time. You were not with me for the years that I was reading and went to monastic retreats and did silent retreats and meditative and wrote and prayed and journaled each morning. If you want, read my journals. You can see where this comes from. But take my whole story. And the fact that I was a storyteller is actually very relevant because this is all about story.
That's right.
It's
That's
all
right.
about story.
I mean, what you were saying is the flaw and the potential solution lies very much in our story.
That's right.
Okay. That's right. You also confront other potential criticisms, in fact, many of them, in what you term the fear and truth dialogues. Now, I'm going to ask you a couple of things. One, I'll let you tell people what those are and how they show up in the book. But what was your creative process in coming up with that device? Did you even have a fear and truth dialogue about whether it was a good idea?
Well, fear and truth came late. And whenever you write something that's so outside the societal box, at least for me, there's a voice that says the first reaction will be dismissive. This is crazy. This is idealistic. This is utopia.
Naive.
Exactly. And late in the book, I had written a number of these essays. Late in the book, a dialogue naturally evolved inside of one of the essays. It was in the happiness section. And then I realized this is a really interesting device because it's challenging, because it pushes the ball further down the hill or up the hill, depending on your point of view. Because if you dismiss me as naive, which fear often does, truth, which what I call my truth, not the ultimate truth, but as I see things, truth gets a chance to look at that and gets a chance to say, well, wait, before you call it naive, I'm not interested in naive things. I'm only interested in what's real. And then fear, of course, says, well, there's nothing real. This is all fringe science or fringe ideas. And truth gets to say, but wait a second. And so it challenges people to a point where they get uncomfortable. And I like that discomfort because that discomfort is where new ideas have a chance to take root. It's always in the discomfort, right? People wish to be settled only in so much as they are unsettled. Is there any hope for them? So this book can be very unsettling.
And the thing that you do, in other words, the device, you let me just guess, a chapter will be about five pages.
There'll be
two or three pages of these dialogues, then another five pages.
Right.
And what happens is he sets up, makes a contention, lays out some research, does whatever, and then before the next chapter, there's this back and forth between your own fear, what fear tells you to shut up, don't be such a wise guy, don't stick your neck out, you know, people will laugh at you, and then your own inner truth, as you say, not the truth, answers and says, but wait, there's this. So you're working it out constantly as you go. And one of the things I saw with that is that in some sense is more of an improv than the rest of the book, if you will. The rest of the book, you do the research, you figure out how to craft it. This is kind of an improv between two sides of yourself, which is one that I think would keep changing. In other words, if you wrote one of those chapters again today, you might have very different reservations and very different...
Yeah. But one thing I did notice, though, about the Fear and Truth dialogues very early, because I wanted to see if it was a device that was provocative, when I gave it to some friends whose, you know, literary tastes I respect, was that they said, I found all my questions being asked by
fear.
I don't think the economy is invented. So I wanted to know where you got the idea that the economy is all made up. And I asked that question. Right. And so that to me told me there was something universal about the fear that I was hearing and possibly even the responses that were coming to fear, because it takes away your defense mechanisms. It removes them. It talks to your fear. And then, again, you get pushed into that very uncomfortable place.
Let me share one last thing about the book before we go into the content, the writing of the book, the structure of the book. There were moments personally when I felt myself a bit manipulated by it. Yeah. Here's why. By inserting the dialogues, you're responding to what might be readers' responses, as you just said. One of my responses was, you set up the big question at the start, you know, is what's at the core of all this? Are there instructions from life to how to live life? What are they? And so on. And then you take a long time answering. And a part of me was saying, enough with the fan dance. You know, what's the answer? My guess is that you did that intentionally with your understanding of story to keep us engaged. Do you get where I'm coming from?
Yeah, well, I don't necessarily write with your experience in my mind, right? So you may be further down the road and you may be saying to yourself as you read some of this, because look, I've heard your radio show. I'm not here by accident. I really respect what you do. So you've asked many of these questions. You've sat inside many of these answers. So you may be looking and saying, all right, come on, Tom, let's go. I think that my conversation is to go back to the place where I first started discovering these ideas. And I wanted to share that experience with the audience. I didn't want to bring them to 2013, the Tom Shadyac today. I wanted to take them back to the 2001, if you will, when I started to realize, uh-oh, I am asleep. I thought I was awake, but I'm asleep. And so I think that is the approach I took to the book, and why at some points you may be saying, giddy up.
Yeah, in other words, there's a secret out there. What is it? But I think I hear what you're saying. And let me just assure listeners, the total is only 240 pages, and it's not a fat book. It's not a big book. Even with my occasional impatience, the trip doesn't take that long.
Yeah, and your impatience may have been your journey because the impatience may have been the idea that needed to sit with you. Because we're all truly those of us, quote unquote, who are further down the path. And this is not an indictment of you. It's an indictment of the idea that, come on, hurry up, people, and get it. You know, I think we're all playing a note. We're all playing a note. This is one note in the symphony, and all of us are playing a note. And I think that we need to respect all the notes being played by others. Not hurry up and get where I'm at. Come on, get where I'm at. It's what note are you playing? I offered this in the very beginning. You know, you said the word you felt manipulated at times. And again, nobody's experience is wrong. Trust me. That's their experience. My intentions and written very early were, please understand that I'm not here to teach you anything. I'm here to share my journey. And if it speaks to you, fantastic. Because that takes down the judgment, I'm somewhere where you need to be. This is something that I've experienced. And if you're experiencing something different, if you're the person who is experiencing wealth and it has brought you all the happiness in the world, you're that percent of a percent who the studies have said is a small percent. I'm interested in you. I want to know what you've learned because my experience is different. Maybe I can learn from you as well. And when the judgment is removed, we can have conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I said, the manipulation was just kind of, you know, I look at these things. I just was going, you know, how's he structuring this? But still, the trip is definitely worth it. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Tom Shadyac, one of Hollywood's most successful comedy directors. Films like Ace Ventura, The Nutty Professor, Bruce Almighty. When an accident stopped all that in its tracks, he questioned everything and did in 2011 a documentary, I Am, and very recently published his first book, Life's Operating Manual. You can learn more at lifesoperatingmanual.com. The big question that you, the big two questions that you ask in this book, again, are?
Well, again, that film I Am, especially, what's wrong with the world, what can we do about it? This question asks a different question, which is, who are you?
Well, but I thought what it asked was, are there instructions, and if so, what are they?
Right. And all has to do
and
with who
the
are you.
And then the answer becomes sort of who are
you? Yeah. Is there an operating manual to life? Right? You know, I start with a short little essay about we accept the idea of an operating manual, whether for a washing machine or a computer. But is there one for life? And I did this talk once and I asked a bunch of young people, where would you look for it if there was one? And you would look at life, right? They eventually came up with it. You would look at life. You would look at a rainforest, an ocean, a coral reef, the biosphere, your own biology. You would look at life. And there are operating instructions around life. There's a great quote that I love from Desmond Tutu when I asked him in I Am, what's wrong with the world? And he said, Tom, and he wasn't speaking in a religious context. He said, Tom, God has given us instructions on the box of this thing we call human being. And we are not following the instructions on the box. And again, he wasn't pointing you to dogma or religion. He was saying that there are instructions, right? And when you reap violence and when you reap aggression, you sow aggression. When you sow, I should say, you reap. And so we're sowing these seeds unaware that are giving us the world that we have. We talk so much about the things on the outside. Like, we look at all the events in the world as if they are apart from us. And when we realize that they are a part of us and not apart from us, that's when we really get to recreate things. Because we are taking responsibility for our energy and who we are, and that will always reflect outwards.
Once we say that we are all connected, once we say, if we make that leap, which, again, if the basic place that we look for answers and instructions always is going to be life around us, and we look honestly, we will see we are all connected. We are all interdependent. One of the things that I have said for a long time is that when people say, what do you mean by a world that just might work? What's that? And I say, well, it's different in all different realms, but it's a worldview. And it's this worldview, rather than defining reality as dead, separate, and static, reality is alive, dynamic, and interdependent, interconnected. And I think, and I say, that if you go to the beach, or you walk in a forest, or you look in the face of a child, this is obvious to you, and yet we act as if it's not so. Once you accept that, though, then that applies to the positive and the negative. Mm-hmm. That's what you were just saying, that the problems are not just out there. That if we are all connected, if we are all one, we are somehow of and part of the problems.
Yeah. I would even take it one step further, that love is actually how things work. And the second I say love, I hope that people haven't changed the channel, the station channel, because I don't mean it as a sentiment. I mean it as a very practical force that may be holding the electron in rotation around the nuclei. Literally, what is holding it? No science can tell you what is love but the attraction, and that somehow that electron is staying in rotation. Love is what moves us and what makes life thrive. So Emerson says in his famous essay, Compensation, that love is the only thing with no negative compensation. Only love multiplies. Only love multiplies. Read Compensation. I can see that you haven't read it.
That's right.
It is literally the essay of all essays of his, and it tells you how life works. So we may have all this technology. We think it's a positive. And I say in the book, it's neither positive or negative. It is just what it is. It's the value that we put into this technology that makes it either positive or negative. Because when we got the car, we lost the use of our feet. You see, there's always a negative. There's a polarity to everything. You only can experience satiation when you know the depths of hunger, right? That first sun in spring is so warm because you know the coldness of winter. The only thing that doesn't have that polarity is love, because love is actually how things work. So I just push it into the next practical, which is even what Einstein said, which is why he said our moral leaders were geniuses in the art of living. He was not saying they were sentimentalists taught to give us something to point at. He was saying they were geniuses in the art of living. And the other thing I want to say, when you said, what does that world look like? It's not a bunch of people in khaki and with scarves on and, you know, tie-dyed shirts. It is all the diversity of life. It is full of arguments. It is full of color. It is full of differences. There are still problems in the world, but we treat each other as family, and we treat nature as family. So what are the rules of family? You can have the petulant young daughter who's not obeying you and doing everything wrong, but you don't let her starve. When she's sick, you take care of her, right?
Well, as you point out at one point in the book, in your one of your dialogues between truth and fear, would you do this to yourself? Well, no, you know. Would you do this to your family? No. To your larger family? To your friends? No. Where do you draw the line? At what point does it become okay for people to be sick and ignored, hungry and ignored, power up, poor and ignored?
Exactly. And there, that point, I think, when we realize that we are actually all family, which the Human Genome Study says we are, we all come from the same two parents, it's traceable lineage, in sub-Saharan Africa, when we realize that, we'll begin to take care of each other at that level. Still have the arguments. This is the way we should do things. This
Families
is the,
argue more than anyone.
Of course. But at the center of the family is a kind of love that takes care of people when they're sick, that feeds them when they're hungry, and educates them as best they can. And those are the basic things I think we need to understand to have what you call this world that actually works.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you said love, not sentiment, but actually the attractive force that holds things together, gravity, in some sense, is very similar to that. We cannot explain it, just as we cannot explain love, but it holds things together. There's a wonderful book by Brian Swim called The Universe is a Green Dragon. I don't know if you're aware of it. Swim is a cosmologist, and it really talks about this allurement, is his term, but this thing that draws everything together with the same meaning.
Maya Angelou says it's the force that moves the blood in the veins.
So I want to talk just again about a couple of the big ideas in here. One is this thing, learning from nature. Anything else about learning from nature that you want to say? In other words, one is, if you look at nature, everything's connected. If you look at nature, it's ecosystems that are thriving, not individual organisms. If you look at nature, no one takes too much, takes more than they need. There's no such thing as waste, et cetera. Any other things in
well
that?
Well said. Well, the counter to all that is how we've set up our economy, the way we do business with each other. And it's not just the economy. That's how we educate. We're teaching our kids. Look at the Department of Education's website says we're training our kids for global competitiveness. That's the goal of our educational system. So it's all about this way we do business with each other. And what happens when a system takes more than they need? We have a term for it, and it's cancer, right? A cancer is a system that is just taking all that it can, right? It's just saying, wow, I'm pretty powerful here. I can continue to eat. I'll keep eating and multiplying. And then it doesn't realize it's breaking down its host. So we're that right now. We literally advertise it on television. We teach it in our schools. We don't realize it. It's why kids are walking into school with guns. It's the root reason that we have put them into a competitive, violent ideology. You are to compete with each other and berate and beat each other. Well, beat each other and then berate each other comes out of that. But you're to compete with each other, not cooperate with each other. And until we learn that and we teach our kids that, if you're the greatest violinist in school, fantastic. You play your note, you do your violin, and then give what you can to those around you. And if the other person's the greatest legalist, the strategist, let him teach you. And you can work together, not against each other.
It's interesting. Last week's guest was Rafe Esquith, the award-winning fifth grade teacher in L.A., who I've had a number of times. And one of the things that he does in his classroom is this a lot of group work. And there's even former students come in, and it's all this cooperation.
Yeah, competition comes from the word competere. It means to strive with. So when Larry Bird and Magic Johnson strove with each other, they made each other more excellent. They needed each other. But the poison that follows that is, oh, you get $200 million because you're the best. And the guy sweeping the floor gets nothing and can't educate his kids and can't feed his family. That's the poison. And until we see that it's a privilege to be in the arts, to be in the sports, and that we're all in this together, and that we have a much more egalitarian system of paying each other, because we feel it. It's not going to come from any system. We have to feel that equality, right? I don't want any laws that say you can only make this much money. I want us to feel it so that it feels like an aberration and an abomination to have so much while others have so little.
You talk about what you say you learned from Daniel Quinn's Ishmael, which is that a lot of the problems started with agriculture. Talk about that turning point.
Yeah, that was when Morgan Freeman said to me, Morgan, what do you know? We were at the dinner one night. Tell me something you know, because I put words in your mouth. And he goes, you ever heard of the tyranny of agriculture? And I thought, maybe. what do you mean? And what that meant was, if you go back to some of the moral teachings of Jesus, don't even store into barns. Right? Consider the birds of the air. They don't reap or sow or even store into barns. Agriculture was the first time that we as a species were able to store into barns. And a kind of greed, understandable, because we didn't want to die. We wanted to have plentitude. And so we started chopping down more and more and more of the forest. We started eating up more and more of the fields and storing. And then we started to look at that storage and say, he has more than I do. I want what he has. And then this whole ideology came in. That is what's meant by the tyranny of agriculture. It's that we have this way of taking everything we can. And if nature did that, nothing, of course, would live. It would be this gross competition. And the lion would eat every gazelle. He wouldn't just eat just one.
That's right.
He would eat every gazelle, and he would kill everything around him.
If nature did that, we wouldn't have ever been here.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. We got here through sympathy and cooperation.
Right, right. And so agriculture allowed for exploitation. It allowed for setting aside exploitation. And
this is when slavery shows up in the human species. There's no slavery before. What's good is a slave going to do when you're a hunter-gatherer culture and you have another mouth to feed? Everybody works together. They're dependent on nature.
As you point out, the Bushmen of the Kalahari have a sustainable civilization, a sustainable society going on 50,000 years.
Right.
And it's egalitarian. It's shared. It's bare.
Right.
There's no luxury.
Right. They have the luxury of survival.
They have
which
a luxury
we may not
of
have.
Survival. Exactly.
Yeah.
I must share when I came upon that one. I've mentioned this before in the show, but when I was a freshman in college, in one of my very first courses in social relations, Irvin DeVore, anthropologist, showed a black and white film on the Kalahari Bushmen, and the fact that they, he sort of was questioning the consumption society. And I mean, I'm, 19 or whatever. I remember seeing that and it like blew my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, it stuck. It just changed something about the way I saw the world.
Well, the fact that they don't even say thank you. Tom Hartman introduced me to this idea through Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. you'll give them food if some of the original anthropologists that were researching gave them food. They never said thank you. It's because it's so commonly accepted that food sharing, oh, you have food? Of course you share it. And Tom likened it to pulling up at a traffic light. You don't thank the car next to you for stopping because it's just assumed that we all obey traffic laws.
Right.
And it's just assumed in their society that you share food.
Right. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Tom Shadyac. We're talking about the work in his book, Life's Operating Manual. And you can learn more at lifesoperatingmanual.com. Let me engage, if you will, in a little bit of some things that occurred to me reading your book and get your reflections on it. One is that it may sound like what you're saying is if one at a time we can shift our worldview, if one at a time we can shift the way we view reality, if one at a time we can see some of this stuff and begin to live from it. And one of the responses to that is these issues are societal. There are big corporations, big institutions that don't see things that way. One of my thoughts is that, talking again about the Bushmen, about agriculture was only 10,000 years ago. The Industrial Revolution, 300? It seems to me that what we're living in is a brief period where we had enough energy and enough that was perceived as cheap energy, enough technology and the certain culture to expand our extensions of ourselves, as McLuhan said. That's our ability to see, to hear, to communicate, to think, all those things, to move, certainly very, very critical, which expanded in turn population, consumption, pollution, disposal, our ecological footprint, all of that. And that was a blip in a way. And that what we're now seeing is the cost of that much population, that much pollution, that much disposal, etc. And so now we are those in this moment when we've got to pull back from what looked possible, from what looked like progress, and reassess and shift. And my thought is, this transition is going to take some time. I think you're right that it's a big part of it's going to be individual consciousness. And I don't criticize us for actually saying individual consciousness matters. My goal would be that as few people get as hurt and hurt as little as possible during this transition, those who have been thrown out of those houses, those who live on a dollar a day in Africa, and that justice somehow prevails during this transition. Your thoughts about that?
I love that. Justice always prevails. The justice is sown in the consequence is sown in the deed. So just because a person doesn't go to jail doesn't mean that there's not justice served. We've all seen the Zimmerman case. Whatever side you fall on, justice is already served. So I just want to say that to begin with. We're at a very, very, very interesting time. First of all, we're not going back. So when we talk about the Sam Bushman, we're not going back. I think that this was life's way of saying, you know what? I want to get more creative. I want to just really push that envelope, as you said, to expand, to see what can we do? Where can we go? How can we experience more diversity? And so we have all these technologies and all these inventions. Now we have to change the ethos behind those technologies and those inventions. That's it. So we still are going to want energy. We're still going to be looking for energy supply, but we have to change the ethos behind it. It can't harm other life that we need to coexist with. It can't harm the future of our own children's future of the species. So we need to simply shift the ethos and say, as nature does, how do we do this without waste? Like a doctor does, with no harm. How do we do this with no harm? And if we can't do it with no waste and no harm, we can't do it. We've got to look for another door. And if we can't find that other door, it's not time then to go through any of these doors. So the majority of this has to do with shifting the God. The God of our lives is money. It's so perfect that it's written on our money, right? God is on our money, and God we trust, right? Because it's the opposite, right? It's like, what does the devil do, in the old stories? He puts it right in front of your face, right? What is the symbol of apple, right? It's the story. It's a bite out of the apple, right? It's from the story of the Garden of Eden, right? I mean, of Eden, of Adam and Eve. right? It's the bite in the apple. It's like, oh, I'll stick it right in their face. They won't even see it, right? And so when we shift this God of money to the God that is what I call God, which is life, love, connection, all those things you mentioned, it's all going to change.
And, you know, one thing that I certainly saw in your book, is, and you, I think you mentioned it, expressions like get real or but in the real world,
right,
are very often the answers to something like what you just said. And what they usually mean is money.
Yeah.
Or even, I would say, when they say get real or in the real world, they say money and evil are what count.
The funny
thing
is,
if you don't take those two things into account, you're fantasy land.
It's the funny thing is that's the ultimate unreality. If I pull out a dollar right now, right, a $100 bill and a Tootsie Roll, and we're on a desert island, guess what's more valuable? It's only the idea we place behind it. It's not real. It's the idea we place behind it. And when we realize that all this stuff, you know, when you said corporations, some criticism of my work is that I do talk about the individual transformation and I don't give enough credit to people coming together. And I certainly don't intend that at all. However, I don't believe anything exists outside of the individual ethos, meaning that there isn't a corporation that exists in the world that doesn't follow us. They're all followers. Shell Corporation is a follower of us. The second we all come together, again, it's coming together, but through individual realization as well, saying, John Francis, we talked about in the book, he gave up driving himself. People thought he was crazy. He started one of the founders of the environmental movement. I can make a difference with my one act, right? He shifted me. Now I don't drive as much. I bicycle. And when enough people come together and say, I'm not going to drive, watch Shell go, can't wait to find that new thing.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that we do see is the sharing economy. I don't know if you've been following this, but
I have,
because of technology, we are now able to connect with people and reference people. And because of the social networking and the speed of all of that, we now have car sharing. We now have home sharing. We now have but this is Airbnb. This is Lyft. This is Uber. This is Sidecar. This is all these things. This is, I think, the most disruptive thing that's come along in a while. And it's interesting that it's the arc of the technology, you know, that has sort of in some way separated us and made us so avaricious that may actually say, well, wait a minute. I don't need a car.
Right.
If I live in an urban population and I have a social network, I do not need a car. What I was thinking was that prior to a certain point, and it's either the discovery of oil or World War II or something, people went after, for the most part, the majority of people went for what they needed. There were the wealthy, there were the greedy, but most people. And then World War II, every house needed a car. Every house needed a washing machine. And then it got worse than that, right? And it seems to me what's happening now among, really a lot among a young generation, which you say is picking up on your book, is saying, well, wait, I don't need that. There's a cost to that,
right,
whether it's maintenance or monthly payments or all of this. And so I do see some trends where, you know, again, technology that took us there is now maybe going to give us a way to get out of there.
Yeah. Well, I just don't want to put the cart before the horse, and I don't want to bow to something that I consider a false idol. And technology, to me, is a false idol because it is only the ethos that you're talking about that is now spreading. The greatest story, I think, almost inarguably in history, is what's called the Jesus story, whether you believe in it or not. It certainly is a story that is spread with more power. And it was spread long, well before technology, because there was a truth and a power in that story. Now, could it spread quicker now because of technology? Certainly. But it is the story itself that has the power, right? The technology is a tool in the hands of that power. So let's give power to what the real revolution is, which is people are beginning to wake up to how things work, to the fact that the way we're doing things isn't working. They're finding in themselves something more powerful about community, about engagement, about activism, about taking care of each other, sharing their talents and their time, creating strong families and communities, growing food that actually is healthy and sustainable. They're finding a power there. That's where the real power is. Thank God, through no accident, we have a technology
now
that can spread
that. Right, it's an enabling mechanism,
But let's not put the technology as the God.
It's a tool.
because that's the argument that people will make for having coltan in our cell phones, right? For having women in China who are being poisoned through, you know, different methods of constructing these phones, you know, that's what we need to look at. Because otherwise we say the technology is worth it. We got to get the technology. It's not. The ethos, and then use the technology as a tool.
Okay, we've come to the end of the hour, and I had a bunch of more good questions. So again, the book is Life's Operating Manual. The website is lifesoperatingmanual.com. Thank you, Tom Shadyac. Keep up the good work.
Brother, thank you. Appreciate
for this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests, what we're going to talk about, three or four articles of background, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Free Forum on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again. Mike.
Cheney, when your lips move your line, give me a break. Your head's up your ass, you've been drinking. Justice will be when you're in jail.
Everyone, Juliana Forlano here from Absurdity Today on the Progressive Voices Radio Network. Join me, along with some of today's best political satirists, to discuss the important issues of our day on the Juliana Forlano Show. And guess what? We promise to do it in a way that won't make you want to hide under your bed. Our show has jokes, parody, and political satire, alongside interviews with powerful speakers and important newsmakers like activists, scientists, thinkers, and people who prefer peace to war. You'll find the Juliana Forlano Show on the Progressive Voices Radio Network every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Pacific, and again on Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific. Or download our podcast at julianaforlano.com.
Hey, Truth Seekers, it's Church Night on the Molloy Show. That's when we take a peek into the minds and actions of this country's Christian fascists. Oh, yes, they do exist. For example, the Green family, they own all those Hobby Lobbies, and they want everyone to do and think what they do and think. In fact, they've gone to the Supreme Court to make sure that happens. Additionally, they are spending hundreds of millions to teach a sinful nation the proper Christian way to behave. Join me, Mike Molloy, at 9 p.m. in the East, 6 p.m. in the West, on Progressive Voices Channel on TuneIn Radio.